Welcome to this edition of the Huron Consulting Group podcast series. In this series, Huron Consulting Group executives share insights on the issues and trends that are shaping the industries we serve.
Hello, this is Edwin Eisendrath. I'm a managing director at the Huron Consulting Group, and this is another in our podcast series on innovation and globalization of higher education. And I am joined today by Shamu Idris, who is the Chief Executive Officer of SOLIA, which is an international nonprofit organization that is really interesting. It's dedicated to empowering young people to use new media tools, but its true impact is in connecting across cultures. Really interesting things that have been done. And Shamil, thank you for joining me. And I just wonder if you'd tell us a little bit, even before we get into SOLIA, your company, or what it can do for universities, your fabulous story of how you came from a path of really peacemaking, important peacemaking in the world, and conflict resolution to this post.
Sure. Yeah. Well, thanks for having me. And you're right. My background is very much in international peace building, more so than in education per se. And my wife is a professor at the education school at New York University, and about to become sort of the head of international education there. So it's in the family, but actually I come right more out of a sort of international mediation and conflict resolution background. I worked for about a decade for an international conflict resolution organization called Search for Common Ground, which was one of the bigger nonprofits in that field. Doing things like, you know, finding any possible ways to open up lines of communication and cooperation across dividing lines. So I lived in Burundi during the civil war there, where we started a radio studio that had both ethnic Hutu and ethnic Tutsi staff and journalists doing both news reporting together and soap opera programs that you could use to that entertainment format, you know, to help bridge divides across ethnic lines during the Civil War there, you know, work to start the first, you know, exchanges, public exchanges between the U.S. and Iran since the revolution. We sent the American national wrestling team to Iran for a match, but that opened up, you know, sort of more behind-the-scenes dialogues at a political level. So I was very engaged in that kind of work, and I subsequently took up a position briefly at the World Economic Forum, where we started something that at that time was called the Council of 100 Leaders. It was an effort in particular to open up relations and foster cooperation between sort of Western and Muslim-majority societies. I was then was fortunate enough to be appointed by the former Secretary General of the UN, Kofi Annan, to help lead an initiative called the Alliance of Civilizations. And that UN effort was really, again, focused on how to counter sort of growing cross-cultural polarization, particularly between Western and Muslim-majority societies. So in that role, I was, you know, fortunate enough to work with some heroes of mine, you know, Archbishop Tutu and former heads of state and foreign ministers from around the world that were tasked as a sort of high-level group with presenting an analysis and a plan of action to Kofi Annan on how to address this divide. And after I left the UN, we started, you know, I left the UN to run a media fund that was intended to try to use mainstream media production, in particular filmmaking, to try to open up lines of communication and understanding across cultures. And within 6 months of taking up that post and running, you know, getting that startup going, this media fund, I saw after meeting with a lot of Hollywood executives and others that, to my perspective anyway, the most important medium for fostering cross-cultural understanding and respect was the exploding field of new media communications and not so much the more traditional mainstream media outlets, because for the fundamental reason that new media platforms enable interaction and, you know, the big paradigm shift from the old media to the new media was going from sort of a media distribution model where the game was all about who has the biggest megaphones that can reach the most eyeballs or ears to who can establish platforms that enable people to interact with one another most creatively. And if what you're really interested in is international understanding and fostering a more peaceful world, that whole specter of media's paradigm shifting to a more interactive place becomes really exciting. And so within 6 months of starting that media fund, we sort of looked around for organizations that were using new media in really creative and innovative ways to advance cross-cultural education, cross-cultural understanding. And we found Solia, and that was an organization that I hadn't been unaffiliated with. I had actually been one of the first people, you know, the founder of Solia is a friend of mine named Lucas Welch, who used to be an ABC News producer. And I had joined Solia's board from its first days now 9 years ago. And so had been on the board for several years when, you know, I was looking for good organizations with which to work on sort of new media and peace building. And Lucas and I got to talking, and to make a very long story short, we merged that UN-launched media fund with Solia just over 3 years ago. And I came in as the CEO at that time, and my friend and colleague Lucas became founder and chief innovation officer. And so that's sort of my sort of personal path to where I am. But the fundamental rationale for me, kind of what's been driving me this whole time, is I'm very passionate about scaling up cross-cultural understanding, scaling up the experiences that people have with constructive cross-cultural engagement in education, and how you can do that. Because I think it's always been sort of a nice idea. I now think it's an urgent priority that sort of moved from something that was sort of a nice to have years ago to a must have today.
Well, that's a stunning story, really. And, you know, I'm taken by what it might do for higher ed for a lot of reasons. One is just philosophical. I'm a constructivist, I guess. I think we build our views of the world, and we build them through social interaction with each other. And to the extent that you create social interactions across cultures, you fundamentally change the way young people view the world and interact with the world in meaningful and lasting ways. I know there's a whole bunch of philosophy written on this, from John Dewey to Rorty, and we don't need to sort of dig into the philosophical underpinnings, but you probably have practical examples of changes in behavior and changes in outlook that have happened from these interactions.
Yeah, no, it's great. I mean, you talk about behavior and outlook, and those are two of the three things that we actually look at. We talk about attitudes, skills, and relationships, really. And you know, it was interesting when I went from being on the board to now being the CEO of Solia. The cornerstone program of this organization for years was something called the Connect program, and we're now almost in our 10th year now of running the Connect program. It's been integrated into over 100 universities now in 28 countries. And briefly, that's a program that gets integrated into a university course. So you go, and it's been integrated mostly into the social sciences and humanities, not so much in the natural sciences yet, but it's been integrated in religion courses, media studies courses, political science, international relations courses, sociology classes, et cetera. And so as a student, you go to your class, and on your syllabus, along with whatever else it is that you're supposed to do, read, write, whatever, is your participation once a week in two-hour sessions outside of class time in an online facilitated dialogue with a small, it's almost like a seminar-style roundtable of your peers. Those peers are drawn 50% from countries in Western Europe and the U.S. and 50% from Muslim-majority countries. And what happens over the course of the 8 weeks during which you participate once a week for 2 hours each session in these facilitated dialogues, the curriculum that you follow is really drawn from three different fields, some from conflict resolution, because this is in particular a cross-cultural relationship where there are real misunderstandings, there are in some cases hostile conflict, you know, and just generally a lot of stereotypes. The second field that we draw from the curriculum is sort of cross-cultural dialogue, just generally, even if you're not dealing with conflict, just how do you foster constructive and open discourse across cultural divides, even if you're doing it within the United States, across, you know, cultures. And third, from the field of sort of distance education, what works in that space. And so the way that the curriculum works is, you know, as with all sort of good cross-cultural dialogue or conflict resolution, you don't start by jumping right into the issues that can be very polarizing. So the first session is not about let's say, women's role in society, or what do you think the relationship between religion and politics should be, the first session really gets at personal identity and helps the students to form connections that they might not have assumed were there in terms of just who they are as human beings. So, you know, we have, in order to facilitate our Connect program session for SOLIA, you have to go through 28 hours of training with us. It's very intensive. It's UN-certified training. And so in that first session, for instance, if I'm the facilitator, I might ask the students all to think about, you know, three elements of their identity that are critical to who they are. And it could be something as silly as a soccer team that you love, to your religious or racial identity or whatever else it might be. You're a brother, you're whatever. And then to drop two of those and to share with the group why they kept the one. Why did you keep the one that you did? And just share that with the group. And that starts a conversation just about people's personal identities, kind of who they are, and a lot of interesting humor and kind of connections get made. But as the semester goes on, the curriculum gets into much more divisive and sometimes polarizing discussions on religion, politics, culture, society. And it's highly interactive. So a highlight every semester is a media module where we provide video footage for the students to edit themselves. It's video footage from, it's raw news footage from the Associated Press and Al Jazeera that we get donated. In other cases, it's video footage, for instance, that our team on the ground in Cairo has collected during the revolution. They shot videos on the street with a real range of Egyptians talking about the future of the Egypt, secularists, Islamists, business people, taxi drivers, farmers. And the students in the Connect program were tasked during this 1 week with taking this video footage and editing it into a quote-unquote objective and balanced 90-second news piece that would reflect the diversity of opinion. And what we found
is this idea. So people are constructing their own reality, really, in an area of high controversy, and then they get to talk to each other about the choices they made.
Yeah, that's exactly. And they're all using the same footage. So when
right.
they then come
very
out with totally different narratives, it becomes really interesting.
Yeah, very, very interesting. And this is for what level of student do you normally engage in this?
Mostly with undergraduate students, although we're starting to do with junior graduate students as well.
Talk a little bit about the, if you will, to go from making peace and changing the world to something a little more mundane. What's the business model for this? Do you contract with universities? If I were listening to this and I was at a university, what would I do?
Well, part of why I'm excited to have this conversation with you right now is we reached somewhat of an inflection point. About a year and a half ago, we stopped and looked around at the way we were doing this. And the way we were doing it up until then was basically going door-to-door to different universities, forming relationships with individual professors or sometimes with the administration to integrate the program into one or two courses at a time. We launched something called the Exchange 2.0 Coalition a year and a half ago with a consortium of other organizations that do web-based cross-cultural education and dialogue programs, so that we could shift the entire ecosystem around international education and exchange. And I'm getting to answer your question. The reason I'm sharing that is we want there to be resources now for universities and even high schools and primary schools to draw upon in order to integrate what we're calling virtual exchange programs into their curriculum. A virtual exchange program is defined as technology-enabled, sustained. It's not just a one-off, web chat. It's sustained over the course of whether it's a semester or however long. It's curriculum-based, and it's cross-cultural in nature. And so the reason that we've sort of made this push to establish this virtual exchange field as a field is because right now, until about a year and a half ago, it's been quite hit or miss. If an institution had the resources to pay for this kind of programming, they could. If they didn't, we would run around and raise philanthropic dollars. We've done quite well with that. We've grown, every semester up until a year and a half ago. And at that point, we decided really what we're onto here is something that we believe fundamentally could shift the state of international education by making international exchange available to the 98 plus percent of students who will never participate in a study abroad or physical exchange program. That's the fundamental model. And so now, if you're a university and you're interested in this, we'd urge you to contact us at SOLIA. Of the coalition partners right now, we're the only Exchange 2.0 coalition partner that focuses on higher education. But increasingly, what we're trying to do is shift the funding ecosystem so that governments, foundations, corporations that support exchange will be supporting virtual exchange. And I can say we've made real progress on this just in the last year. The Senate Appropriations Committee this year for the first time attached a report with the State Department authorization bill in which they directed the Secretary of State to consider using some of the non-allocated funds that are in that budget, the non-earmarked funds in that budget, to support specifically virtual exchange programs because they offer the opportunity to reach a scale and a diversity of students who otherwise would never have an international experience. And more recently, you know, just last week, we had an event in which the head of global engagement for the National Security Council at the White House expressed the interest of the Obama administration to work together with us to make virtual exchange, to scale up virtual exchange opportunities, you know, going forward. If you're at university,
that's an amazing impact on policy. And, you know, this comes at a time when the same kinds of technologies are used to change the almost ancient relationship between professor and student, to change the way classrooms operate, flipping them, which we've heard a lot about in these conversations, delivering content one way and more broadly and more efficiently, and allowing these media then allowing the in-person time in a classroom to be used not only more efficiently, but to better effect, and at the same time to connect groups of students who are disparate in some sense, sometimes classes where you have campuses on one continent and another, so that students can actually share a class without being co-located. And now you're talking about taking that beyond and really saying the entire student experience can benefit, as it has benefited a few students, from including a real immersion in other cultures and with people with very different viewpoints as part of that experience, and now it's affordable in a broad scale.
That's true. I mean, right now, just to give you a sense of this, at the University of Amsterdam in the Netherlands, if you're going to get a master's in international relations, you need to take our Connect program. There is no reason, in my view, certainly in international relations, but I would make the case, frankly, in pretty much any field, that in a world in which the workplace is increasingly globalized and diverse, students need to graduate with some experience in dealing with cross-cultural difference effectively, and especially if you're going to be graduating in fields like international relations or in political science and dealing with the world at large. I think this kind of thing is indispensable, and we can't, frankly, rely on the 1%, at most 1.2%, that currently participate in study abroad or exchange programs as the way that we're going to be preparing our students for globalized, you know, economy. The other thing I would say in terms of professors, you know, I think one of the things that we've heard from professors again and again, who integrate our program tend to become, frankly, very strong champions for this approach, is a couple of things. One is the time what you as a professor have in your class. Let's say your class meets every Thursday. Every one of your students has now participated over the previous week in an international dialogue on the subjects that you're looking at in your class. But they're all participating in different groups. We try to make sure we don't have two students from the same institution. Oftentimes, we don't have two students from the same country in the same sort of eight-person dialogue group. So your class is now enriched by every student having had, you know, this one's participated with a French, a German, a Qatari, and an Egyptian student, whereas that student has participated with a Malaysian, a Moroccan, you know, a Dutch, and mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And that really enriches the student's understanding of the different perspectives on the issues that they're learning, and especially if they're learning anything with an international flavor, they're really beginning to learn with other people and not just about other people, and that's a very powerful transition. And the last thing I would say, in terms of professors, mm-hmm. what we've heard from professors, one of the well-established, you know, sort of pedagogical rules of thumb is that spaced learning is much more effective than mass learning. if you're looking at what really results in long-term integration of lessons and deep understanding, which is to say, if you try to jam some exotic or different experience all into one period of time, it tends to sort of stick with people much less than if they have an iterative experience over time with that other. And so let's say you're participating every 2 hours in an online dialogue with peers from around the world, and you're immediately going right back to your normal framework, whether you live in Gaza or you live in, you know, Odessa, Texas. And then the next week, you're having again that experience, and it's a constant iterative back and forth. And that's what they call spaced learning, and found that the sort of lessons of that get much more integrated over the long-term students' thinking than if you jam everything into, let's say, one intense week abroad where you're kind of engaging with people and then you come back. And it's sort of it's the same thing as sort of if you cram for your exam at the end of your semester versus studying a little bit every week.
Mm-hmm. You know, I'm taken by the similarities of what you're doing and the traditional view of liberal arts education. I know you spoke about the connection to particular curricula, for instance, in foreign affairs, but what you're really doing, which advocates of liberal arts education for years talked about when they talk passionately about literature, is that you are immersing young people in other points of view and other realities, and in doing so, changing the way they look at the world, opening their minds to thinking creatively about problems, thinking in new ways about the world they see every day in front of them. And this is an old value for higher education that hasn't been advocated very strongly in this we all need to use our schools to get a job economy. But we find when we talk to employers, the thing they value most in the employees they have are their ability to manage in a diverse environment, their ability to resolve conflicts in the workplace, their ability to move forward in a world of people who are different. So really, this is an old value with some new tools, and really exciting new tools, to make something that has been an elite offering for centuries more broadly accessible. Do I have that right?
I think not only is that right, but I think if you think about it, you know, this is just in the last 10 years, this is the first time in human history that it's actually been even practical for us to do this at scale. We now have the technology, the technical tools, technological platforms and new media tools at our disposal that we can actually reach the other, you know, 98%+ of students who otherwise would never have this kind of an opportunity. We have a professor, you know, I interviewed a professor in rural Egypt who's been integrating a program, who told me the story just a few months ago that during the revolution in Egypt, students in his class risked their physical safety to go to a local internet cafe so that they could participate in these weekly two-hour sessions. And other students would go and stand guard outside the cafes because it was such an insecure time and there were riots and the campus was all but closed down, so they couldn't have access to the computer lab there. And for students in the U.S. to know the lengths to which, and the reason that they're doing things like that isn't just because they love education. You talked about the importance of interacting with other perspectives. One of the really primary things that we've seen for students is, and this professor in Egypt articulated in exactly these terms, this is a way for young adults also to better come to understand and know themselves through the interaction with others. They begin to understand what their assumptions and biases are. They get clear about what their own principles are. They realize the value of being given a voice and being heard. And it's really powerful. And if you're studying, let's say you're studying gender issues, for instance, to be able to have a direct face-to-face interaction with, for instance, a Saudi woman who's your age, who's wearing the hijab, the headscarf, you know, and you can ask her anything you want, and she's going to do the same with you. That's very powerful. You can't really substitute for that. And so, absolutely, I think you're very much right in that. What's exciting to me is that we have it now within our means to do this at scale for the first time ever.
Well, this is fabulous, and I can't believe this, but we're out of time. And I hope that we can continue this conversation. There are many more aspects of this I'd love to explore, but I'm very grateful for your time today.
Well, thanks to you. It's a real pleasure.
You've been listening to a Huron Consulting Group podcast. For more insights from our executives or to learn more about Huron Consulting Group, please visit our website at www.huronconsultinggroup.com.